Last summer, at the height of a bitterly contested and hugely consequential presidential campaign, a foreign adversarial power intervened in an effort to weaken our democracy and to influence the outcome for one candidate and against the other. That foreign adversary was, of course, Russia, and it acted through its intelligence agencies and upon the direct instructions of its autocratic ruler, Vladimir Putin, in order to help Donald J. Trump become the 45th president of the United States.
Democratic California Congressman Adam Schiff today at the hearing into Russia's influence in the presidential election. FBI Director James Comey said today that the Russians did try to influence the election by hacking into DNC emails and by trying to access voter registration databases. And he says the FBI is investigating whether that hacking was coordinated with the Trump campaign. Here to talk about how this is playing in Russia is Alec Loon. He's a contributor to The Guardian, and he joins us from Moscow. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so U.S. intelligence is certain that Russia hacked the election. Does Russia dispute that?
Yes, it does, very vociferously. It's kind of like looking at the opposite side of the mirror here. For months now, Russian officials have been denying any sort of connection to the hacking, denying any interference in the U.S. election, and really ridiculing U.S. accusations having to do with that.
And what is the basis for their ridicule? Why do they think that is absolutely ridiculous?
Well, there's been a lot of just straight out denials saying that Russia is not interested in interfering. The biggest one came from Vladimir Putin himself, who said, rather strangely, he said, why does it matter who did the hacking? What matters is the information that was eventually brought to light. And a lot of Russian officials have been saying that there's no evidence being presented. They're saying that these news reports based on leaked information don't hold any water. They're saying that if there was really hard evidence, that it would have been presented by now. And one argument that's being made is that the U.S. has no place in criticizing other countries for interfering in elections because the U.S. itself has interfered in foreign elections in the past.
So what do Russians make of the fact that we have been talking about this pretty obsessively since November 8th and here in America? What do they make of the fact that they are the center of a lot of political news here?
You know, I just to give you some anecdotal evidence, I spoke to a Russian friend recently who had come back from New York, a trip to New York, and he was telling me how he was shocked and that he thought there was what he called hysteria. He said there was some sort of anti-Russian hysteria going on in the United States right now. And I said to him, well, you know, you realize that how serious these accusations are, but he just didn't see. Similar to what the media has been saying here, he said that he didn't see any evidence, that he said no evidence had been presented, and that he thought that it was being blown out of proportion. So this is one issue where even well-educated, generally liberal Muscovites who kind of run in the same circles here in the Capitol as I do, even they're very skeptical that Russia had a role in this.
And are they skeptical because they're not getting news from the West, that they're getting most of their news from RT, for example?
Well, I don't think they're getting their news from RT. They're getting their news from either state television, all nationwide news television in Russia is controlled by the state, or they're getting it from Facebook, which, you know, or the Russian version of Facebook, which could be what have you, any sort of, you know, wild information. They're not reading the Western media in general. That's I don't know a lot of Russians who read news in English. And yeah, I think part of the reason is that they're getting a slightly one-sided view in the media of what's happening. I think they're also just very skeptical after that, you know, this story has been going on for so long now, and there have been so many different allegations of Russian interference, and it's coming on the heels of the doping scandals and the Ukraine crisis and Russia's annexation of Crimea and all the things that have been happening over the past few years. I think that at this point, a lot of them feel that Russia's being victimized unfairly by the West, and that I think that some of them are ready to buy into officials' claims that there is a Russophobic campaign going on in the U.S.
And so does that translate into stronger support for Vladimir Putin?
I think it does to a certain extent. One thing, for instance, here when sanctions were adopted by the U.S. against Russia, a lot of people here were saying, you know, that sanctions only make us stronger. And there's really a certain kind of rally around the flag effect that you get when U.S. politicians are accusing Russia of this and that. There is sort of a reflex to kind of rally around the flag. There is a bit of national pride involved. And I think that, we can see from the polls that sanctions haven't hurt Putin. We can see from the polls over the past few months that these allegations of hacking have not hurt Putin. Putin's ratings are still in the high 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. his popularity ratings. So it appears to not be affecting them at the very least.
Right. And so those polls are conducted by whom?
Well, there is some polling done by state pollsters, which you would expect some inflation there, but also polls done by a very well-known independent pollster here. You know, that also shows huge popularity for Putin. I think anybody who comes to Russia and goes out to, not just in Moscow, but goes out to the regions and talks to people will realize that Putin is very popular here. And a lot of that has to do with his image for being the leader who resurrected Russia, who brought Russia up off its knees and stood up to the West like Russia did back in the Cold War.
And what do Russians make of Donald Trump? Do they like him?
Russians do like Donald Trump. I mean, even I remember seeing a poll even back last summer that Russia was the one G20 country, the lone G20 country where Trump was far more popular than Clinton. And that's definitely carried over. State television here has been talking so much about Trump and in such a positive light that there have actually been protests in recent weeks, nationalists protesting state Russian television. So pro-Kremlin nationalists protesting pro-Kremlin state television, saying that it's devoting too much time and too much positive coverage to Trump. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty good indication of what kind of coverage Trump has been receiving in the official media here.
Too much positive coverage of Trump. What are they upset over, that they're not getting Russia news, that it's just too much American news?
Yeah, that's part of the argument that this is too much American news. But, you know, the flagship TV program here, which is led by a guy called Dmitry Kiselyov, after the election took a very strong pro-Trump stance and was dismissing any accusations or claims against Trump were being dismissed on this primetime television show as just the angry Democrats trying to get back at Trump for beating them in the election. And there was a very strong kind of pro-Trump angle to the news coming out of that for a while. Now, of course, in light of these protests, in light of kind of the furor that's actually caused, that's been scaled back a little bit. But there was definitely a very strong pro-Trump slant for a couple months.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Alec Loon. He's a contributor to The Guardian from Moscow. Coming up here at home, what California plans to do with all the tobacco tax money it's collecting and how police officers can check if a driver is high. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Vote yes on Prop 56. Keep our children from smoking. Improve health care. Reduce tobacco-related health care costs. And save lives. Yes on 56.
That's an ad from last year. Well, California voters did vote yes on 56, which raised taxes on tobacco. The new law is estimated to bring in more than $1 billion this year to help fund health care. But there's a fight over where the money should go. Governor Jerry Brown is battling with doctors groups over who should get the money. For more on that, we're joined now by Melanie Mason, political reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi there.
Hey, good afternoon.
Well, Prop 56 said the money should go to health care. Anything more specific?
Slightly more specific. So there were certain ways where the measure designated how the money should be spent, but mostly it said that the vast majority of the money, about 82%, should go to increasing healthcare spending, and it mentions increasing provider payments. And that's the real sticking point of this budget debate that we're seeing in the Capitol right now. Doctors and dentists and other proponents of this initiative really wanted to see the money go towards making providers get more money in reimbursements for when they see Medi-Cal patients, which is, of course, the subsidized health care program for the poor. But what Jerry Brown says is he's saying we just need to increase the money for Medi-Cal overall, the overall health care spending, and they insist that that's in line with the initiative. And that's really what the tussle that we're seeing in the Capitol is about.
So increase in money for Medi-Cal overall, that what would that mean exactly? Would that be expanding coverage to more people?
Right. There's more program costs that we're seeing, particularly that the state has to pay. One of the reasons is that the way that the Affordable Care Act was written, when states have the option of expanding Medi-Cal access or Medicaid access to childless adults, essentially, which is what California did enthusiastically, the federal government said at first we'll cover the entire cost of what it takes to cover these new expansion patients. But eventually they were going to decrease what they would be paying, sort of stepping it down year by year, and the state would have to pony up more money. And so what we're seeing now is as the Brown administration is trying to put together its budget, they're saying the state needs to pony up more because the federal government's paying less. We're also seeing, they're saying that we're having slightly lower revenues next year than we did last year. So they're saying that in order to keep covering the Medi-Cal population that California has been covering, they need to use this tobacco tax revenue to do so.
Well, meanwhile, though, doctors are saying we just can't afford to treat all these patients. Doesn't Medi-Cal cover about a third of California's population?
It does. And I think that that's really a key question that we're hearing now is there's clearly been a huge expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act here in California. But now the question is access. With all of these new patients coming into the program, are they actually able to get in to see a doctor? And what the doctors and dental groups are saying is that because California has some of the lowest reimbursement rates in the nation, they're essentially losing money when they see these Medi-Cal patients. And so therefore, doctors don't really want to participate in the program. In fact, there's a financial incentive not to participate. And so unless you raise the rates, is what the doctors argue, then you're not going to have these newly covered patients able to actually get care.
Wow. So is there any way to split the baby here where a little goes to the doctors' groups and a little goes to the Medi-Cal expansion?
Well, I think that that's probably what will end up happening. I mean, remember, these budget negotiations, this is the opening offer from the Brown administration, and the legislators and the administration have until June to actually work something out. And the doctors' groups are actually out proposing here, well, we will split the baby a bit, because one of the things that is worth noting is the Brown administration has been a little skeptical about the idea that raising reimbursement rates actually will lead to more access and care. They think that, you know, there is a kind of a sense of maybe this is just the medical community looking for more money. So what the doctors and the dental groups have proposed last week, which I wrote about, was, okay, fine, we'll split the difference and we will give more money to people who are already seeing Medi-Cal patients, basically incentivizing doctors to participate in the program. They say that way you really are targeting these incentive payments to get doctors, to reward the doctors who are seeing more patients and to encourage more doctors to participate.
What about the whole idea that they're using a tobacco tax for this? Is there some kind of ethical quandary there? In other words, they're kind of relying on people to keep doing something that's really unhealthy to fund this program.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it frankly is, I mean, you know, tobacco taxes, you could argue, are actually pretty effective in reducing the smoking rate. And of course, California already has an extremely low smoking rate in the state. So there's both an ethical question and also kind of a practical one of, do doctors really want to link these payments to a behavior that you're hoping will subside as these taxes go up? But one of the important pieces of context to remember is that doctors have been trying to get these reimbursement rates raised for years now, and they've just had no success with the Brown administration. So I think they saw the tobacco tax initiative as kind of a workaround for a budget logjam that they just could not get out of. And so, yeah, maybe it's not the best case scenario for them, but they were not really seeing any other path forward in terms of getting these rates raised.
Well, what do other states do with their tobacco taxes? Same thing?
I'll be honest. I'm not entirely sure how much the rates are tied to that. I mean, I think a lot of the tobacco taxes we see going to smoking cessation programs, research. And by the way, we should note that that's what our tobacco tax does as well. I mean, there is money that goes to enforcement of these new taxes, for example, for research at UCs. For anti-smoking, programs. So it's not just a matter of the reimbursement rates, but the vast, vast majority would be going to this Medi-Cal spending.
Melanie Mason, political reporter for the LA Times, based in Sacramento. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, so we want to hear from you. Where would you channel the money from the cigarette tax? If you're a smoker, does a higher tax mean you buy fewer cigarettes? It now costs around, I think, $8 a pack to buy cigarettes, so that's a lot. Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Well, some drivers in San Diego may have had a rude awakening on St. Patrick's Day. Police officers set up a DUI checkpoint in the downtown area on Friday, but they weren't just looking for alcohol levels. They were also using a special device to test drivers for drug use.
No pipetting, no dripping, no timing. The Draeger Drug Test 5000 analysis system makes sampling quick, easy, and hygienic.
The Draeger 5000, it uses a mouth swab to test for 7 drugs, including marijuana, cocaine, and meth. But there are some issues with it. First, Draeger doesn't reveal the levels of drugs in someone's system, just whether they're there. And there could be some civil rights violations when police use it. Here to tell us more is Allison Margolin. She is a criminal defense attorney specializing in marijuana regulations. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, tell us how this machine works. Is it like a breathalyzer?
Well, it's a little different than a breathalyzer because a breathalyzer, the police officer operates completely, whereas this Draeger 5000, they actually give the person who's volunteered to take this test from whatever reason a little swab, and then they do the swab themselves in the mouth. They hand it back to the police officer, and then they put those into a machine. That takes about 7 to 8 minutes to test on site, which is usually at the place where the person's being detained.
And can the person say, you know what, I don't want to do that?
They can't. This is a completely voluntary type of test. And that's because the DMV, when you get a driver's license, you're only basically giving consent as to a blood, breath, or urine test and not to this kind of test. So it's totally voluntary.
But what happens if you say no?
Well, if you say no, then the officer is not supposed to, I guess, use that for anything. But the problem is that if you say no and the officer still thinks you're under the influence, they can still take you in to get one of these blood, urine, or breath tests. So whether or not this actually has any utility is kind of, I would say, up in the air.
Okay. So if you do take it, though, it doesn't tell you or doesn't tell the officer how much is in the person's system, correct?
No, it doesn't tell the officer anything regarding the levels of drugs in the system. And the other problem is that this may be able to tell an officer if you've consumed something in the last 10 days. I've done quite a bit of research, and it suggests some people, like the government, say that this is only going to be able to detect that day's usage. But when you do a little further research, it seems that people have positive results up to 10 days after, potentially.
And what if you have a driver who's using marijuana for medical reasons?
Well, the thing is, in California, in addition to having our medical defense, we also have Prop 64 that's legalized marijuana for all adults. So the fact that somebody has marijuana in their system isn't evidence of any crime whatsoever in California because of Prop 64, even more over than the medical marijuana laws.
Are there other ways to test if someone is driving under the influence, impaired, I should say, from smoking weed?
Yes. There have been tests that were developed in the early 2000s that were actually tests that you could test one's level of impairment vis-a-vis driving, and they're video tests that a person could do to detect whether or not they're driving carefully. And it won't tell you, is it because of a drug or tiredness or some other impairment factor, but it can more readily determine whether or not someone is in a condition to drive. And to me, that seems to be a much better test than this one.
How does that work?
Well, they had actually never put it into use, but the idea was that there would be a little type of video game that a person could do, and their level of competence would be directly correlated to the multitasking that's involved in driving a motor vehicle.
And meanwhile, there isn't really a threshold, right? A legal threshold for the amount of drugs in a person's system. It's not like a 0.08 blood alcohol level.
That's right. There's no legal threshold for any other drug other than alcohol. So this can only test whether or not a person has used a drug, and it's debatable as to how long. So the relevance of that test towards impairment is very little.
So would an officer have to have probable cause to break out the Draeger 5000?
Well, to break out the Draeger 5000, they don't have to have probable cause. They would have to have at least, I would say, at that point, reasonable suspicion that a person has committed either a traffic offense or a DUI. The thing is that these usually occur at checkpoints. And the way a checkpoint is that in order for the police to do a checkpoint, they have to do certain things in order to make sure it's constitutional. But once you're stopped at the checkpoint, it's my opinion, at least, that you'd have to have reasonable suspicion to continue to detain the person. So you at least have to have some reason to ask the person to even participate in this Draeger 5000.
So it sounds like there are a lot of issues with this, using this machine.
I think there's a lot of issues and it has very little utility.
And yet it sounds like the police in San Diego, at least, are using it.
It sounds like they're using it, but to what end, I really don't understand, other than just, you know, obviously producing some type of monetary benefit towards the manufacturer and giving police another type of device to enter into people's universes. And one thing that's interesting is that as of Prop 64 getting passed, the smell of marijuana is no longer probable cause. So I think the police are looking for another way to, you know, get back into people's vehicles and their homes. And this might be their newest idea.
Or, to be fair, they're looking to make the streets safer and get, you know, dangerous drivers off the roads.
Well, the thing is, if an officer has the belief that someone is unable to operate the motor vehicle based on observable indications, then they don't need the Draeger 5000 either which way. Like, let's assume they do a checkpoint and they make observations that are consistent with someone being under the influence. They can detain that person, take them to the station and do another exam. So I don't even understand how it's even partially useful. Because the cop's observations of someone are going to be more useful in terms of determining if someone's actually under the influence, as opposed to a machine that says whether or not someone's used drugs in the last, you know, several days. And I hope that we have police officers who are better trained to detect that by observing the person, by observing their driving, than this machine.
But maybe they think, oh, well, this could be a whole bunch of different behaviors, I don't know. Or maybe they have a suspicion, but they can't really prove it. And they need some kind of independent analysis from this machine. I don't know.
Well, the thing is, they always have a drug recognition expert that they can call up, and they bring that person to this checkpoint, and the person looks at everyone and says, this person has a problem. That's enough to take that person to the station. So I really, again, don't understand what the machine could be useful for if we have a drug recognition expert that they bring to all these checkpoints if they have a debatable situation. And to me, a human police officer trained to detect that is something I would trust, you know, more than a machine.
And in general, how dangerous is it to be driving under the influence of pot?
Well, it's a hard issue because there have been some studies, such as the LaGuardia study in the 20s, that suggest that some drivers who use it routinely are not impacted negatively in their driving. It seems that it's a personal issue. However, I can tell you that in the states that have legalized medical marijuana, DUIs and traffic fatalities have gone down in every single one of the states that I've researched. So
because they're using that instead of alcohol? Is that the
idea? I think
that's
probably why. I think it's because they're using that instead of alcohol. And I think the incidence of issues is a lot less. Not to say that it's safe for people to drive under the influence of marijuana, but I think that it's a lot more of a personal and debatable thing than using alcohol.
Allison Margolin, criminal defense attorney. She specializes in marijuana regulations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Coming up, how a school in the Yucca Valley became the last best hope for high school dropouts.
I often, you know, tell people that it's important that we plant the seeds and have faith that they will grow at some point in time. It might not be before our eyes, but hopefully they'll eventually grow.
How one principal sees the hope in kids others have written off. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In Yucca Valley, you know, out by Joshua Tree, one alternative high school is the last resort for the, quote, bad kids. They've fallen far behind in their traditional schools, and they struggle to earn a diploma. They're in danger of dropping out. And these kids deal with poverty, unstable homes, and lots of emotional trauma.
I remember sometime in the fourth grade, one of my teachers told me I would never amount to anything. So I kind of just like stuck with that I would never amount to anything. So I thought everything I did was just for no reason.
I get really bad stressing out to the point where like I do not talk to anybody or anything, or I just like try to block out everybody.
Anger builds up in me because of my dad. Like, he yell at me a lot of times. He want me to be a better person than he is. He just bring me down and I don't feel like living sometimes no more.
So at Black Rock High School, they get a second chance, and getting them on the right path means doing things a little differently.
My philosophy is I have no punishments here. You will not get a punishment. We have no lunch detentions, no after-school detentions, no Saturday schools, because that's not the way it works in the real world. If I get in trouble with my boss, she doesn't say, oh, Miss Veland, you have Saturday school. Oh, no, no, no. She comes in, she closes the door, and she says, look, woman, you better get your act together and do it my way or I'm going to fire you. And that's how I handle discipline.
That's Principal Vonda Veland in a new documentary called The Bad Kids. The film premieres tonight on PBS. And Principal Vonda Veland joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also on the line, the co-director of the movie, Keith Fulton. Welcome to you, Keith.
Hello there.
Well, Vonda, let's begin with you. You started Black Rock 5 years ago. What did you want to provide that wasn't being provided to these students?
We wanted to provide a safe haven for the students, a place where they could work at their own pace and excel through the academic program rather than be held back by the system. We've learned through the years that punishments don't work. And so what we do is we try to approach everything on a positive note and spend more time giving the kids affirmations rather than negative reinforcement.
And Keith, you begin the movie with a kid named Joey, and he's being visited by his probation officer. So he had gotten into trouble with the law in the past, and he's sitting on a couch in his house. He's petting his puppy. Tell us more about Joey.
Joey had an endless number of challenges. He had a very difficult upbringing. He had a difficult current home life. He had no father in his world, his family. You know, his mother didn't have a job at the time we started filming. And he just seemed like such an eloquent kid. You know, I mean, talking to him, I used to say to him all the time, you sound like someone I might have gone to college with. So he seemed like the perfect character, and he turned out to be.
Yeah, and he really has a tough time of it with his mom in particular. And so at the beginning, he's really eager to go to school, and then he has some, again, tough times at home, and he decides to leave home. And at one point, he sleeps in a bus stop, or he's sleeping with friends. And then he comes back to school, and Vonda, I want to play a clip of a conversation you had with him.
I wasn't going back to the house.
Okay, why? What's going on in the house?
It was just pretty rough.
Mom being grumpy?
She's always awake.
What's that?
She's always awake.
Are you partying?
No.
Are you clean?
Yeah, kind of.
No, you're not. I can tell by the way you say that.
Kind of, on and off.
You've been in here about the effect of that on your mom.
This is the only way I can deal with her.
I know, but do you see the illogical path that is?
I don't do what she does. I'm completely opposite of her. I've always been opposite of her.
Well, what do you do then?
What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
I like to clean a house. I like to sit in my room, play guitar, or play with my little brother.
No, I'm talking about as far as drug usage goes.
Oh, what do I? Me and her in the same boat. Same stuff.
Well, I thought she was using meth.
Mm.
Oh, dear God, Joey.
So, Vonda, that's a really powerful scene. And so what do you think when you come face to face with that, and with Joey in particular, a kid that you have been working really hard to keep in school, and then you find out that he's been doing meth?
You know, it breaks your heart, but you have to keep hope. I often, tell people that it's important that we plant the seeds and have faith that they will grow at some point in time. It might not be before our eyes, but hopefully they'll eventually grow.
But what happens when they are, as Joey was, repeatedly falling asleep in class, not paying attention, not doing his work, and it's because of the drug use or because of some problems at home?
You know, after time, ultimately, there reaches a point where I end up having to ask them to leave, which is, you know, with Joey in particular, it was probably the worst day in my 30 years in education. It absolutely broke my heart.
And how many kids do you have to ask to leave?
Our quote-unquote dropout rate usually runs about 3%. And so, and at the worst time that we are working together, it's been 5%. It's a rare occasion that we reach a point where we are no longer getting through and we have to ask them to leave.
And Keith, Joey represents what for you when you were doing your research for this movie?
It's a hard question to answer. I mean, I don't see people as necessarily a representation of something, but there's something you were just talking about made me think, you know, I wasn't the best kid in the world, but I had good parents. I probably, when I was in high school, did every drug that came my way, but that didn't ruin my life and it didn't make me lose hope. So when you talk about the fact that, yeah, Joey's doing meth, well, he could do that under other circumstances, but his whole life was so full of difficulty and challenge and no support at home, probably no support from his teachers primarily at school until he got to Black Rock. Look at his whole life. You know, he did not have the kind of support one needs to have in order to succeed or to have hope. And in order not to see yourself as a victim, that's the worst thing about somebody like Joey. They start to see themselves, need to see themselves as a victim.
And really what they wanted to highlight in the movie is that this is a generational poverty issue. And so our job here at the school is to help break that cycle. We can't address all of the individual problems that they're currently living in. What we're trying to do is to give them the skills and the belief in themselves that they can take control of their lives and move forward.
I'm going to play another exchange between you and a boy named Lee. He's in school with his girlfriend, Layla, and they've had a baby together. And Lee is struggling at that inflection point you mentioned, this point where he has to decide whether or not to give up and drop out of school.
You got a lot on your plate right now. You got several issues. You got your mom, you got school, you got Layla, you got the baby. You got the fact that you want to be a teenager still.
I want to graduate. It's not that I don't want to be a teenager, I want to graduate. That's what it is.
Okay, then, all right, you know what, Lee? If you, show me. Get 20 credits this credit check, 6 credit check, and then I'll let you come back and finish in the fall. I know, Lee, what a good man you are and what a big heart you have. So don't act big, bad, and tough with Layla and the ones you love.
So, Vonna, how much of your job is counseling, is helping these kids with their problems versus simply being an administrator and running a school?
90% is with the kids. I come in between 4:30 and 5 to do the paperwork aspect of my job. And then during the day, I want to be available to them all day long, whether it be in the classroom with them or in the hallways or in my office doing counseling. That's the primary focus of my job.
And you say at one point, you told one of the girls, I think it was Brianna, that she is you 40 years ago. What were you like at her age?
A strong-willed, stubborn, opinionated, pig-headed, not willing to listen to others and to just forge forward and do it my way. Did I get in trouble? Absolutely.
For just run-of-the-mill teenage stuff?
Yeah, just not wanting to play the games.
Right. And so you talk about it to these kids. You say it's a game in a way that you just have to do it. It may not have anything to do with the life that you lead after, but you need to learn the game and play by the rules, right?
Well, yeah, one of the things that I found early in my career is if that we lie to the kids and say, oh, everything you do here is going to impact your future, and it's very vital that you learn every standard that is put before you, we lose credibility with the students. So it's very important that we're upfront and honest with them. Some of the geometry or the algebra that they're going to do might not affect their future, but we still have to jump through that hoop in order to get the diploma, which will affect their future. I know in my heart that I make a difference every day.
And Keith, you filmed this movie for what, about 2 years or 1.5 years, about?
2 years.
2 years.
2 years, yep.
And so what kind of changes did you see among the students and the staff?
One of the first things that my partner Lou and I started to notice was what difficulties the staff went through. And you know, the way Vonda set up the school, the staff meets regularly and talks among themselves regularly, which is a really important way that the school functions well. Because if the teachers don't have an opportunity to vent, I don't know how they would cope at all.
Their issues aren't going anywhere. You get involved, you get personally involved. You're going to have to take care of it. And that's emotionally draining.
I lose sleep. I think about our kid who went straight to a homeless shelter.
So I think that they've come up with great coping mechanisms for the teachers. And as far as the students go, I mean, we would see kids who we would think would not make good subjects for a documentary, kids whose faces were blank, their eyes were dead, there was nothing going on in them. But those same kids, weeks later or months later, you would suddenly see them start to liven up, because this is suddenly they felt part of a community.
And how much counseling training do the teachers receive? Because they're dealing with some pretty heavy issues. There's one girl, Jennifer, she admits her grandfather is sexually abusing her. How do your teachers, Vonda, handle that? And I assume that they have to call the authorities when they hear of sexual abuse, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're mandated reporters, and that's first and foremost in everything that we do. We've had staff development days on handling students who are in trauma, but it's pretty much just us all working together and trying to brainstorm solutions. And when one of us or many of us are feeling like we're going to give up on a student, there's always one that says, oh, hey, let's try this, or we haven't done that yet, or send the kids to my classroom. I'll take them all day and give all the rest of you a break. And so we just really support each other.
Are there times when you think, I'm really not capable of handling this, these deep-seated mental health challenges?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I wrote a book called Lessons from the Bad Kids, and the last chapter of it is knowing when to call in the reinforcements, because there are times where I have cutters who are, you know, damaging their bodies so badly that I can't handle that counseling on my own. And at that point in time, you know, we do all our best to bring in outside resources.
There's a girl in your office in the movie who is about to graduate, and she is in tears. She's terrified of leaving. So what does happen next when you've been such a strong support system for these kids for 2 years or so, and then they have to go back out into that world, a world that, you know, has told them time and time again it doesn't want them?
We were struggling with that. Here we build them up and we get them to feel some level of success, and then what? So for the past 2 years, we've been working very closely with the community college here on a program that we call the RISE program, where they come over and meet with our students. We take them out to the college a couple times during the year for field trips. We do all the financial aid process, the assessment process, the enrollment process. And for the past 2 years, we've had a higher percentage of our students attending our local community college than the two traditional high schools.
Hmm. Congratulations.
Yeah.
So what happened with Joey? Did he ever come back?
He did not. Right now, he is clean and sober. We are very happy to say he attends NA meetings 3 times a week. Currently, he is working out at our military base.
And Keith, are you still in touch with Joey?
Joey actually came to live with Lou and I in Los Angeles for a month, and we got him into a rehab program. And I think he sort of started to gain the language of recovery, so-called, in that program. We have longstanding relationships with most of the kids who are main characters in the film. Jennifer is getting a nursing degree. She got a scholarship, actually, from someone who saw the Bad Kids. I think it's Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
She's in nursing school. Lee, I'm not sure what he's doing. He's been maybe flailing about a little bit. But Joey is absolutely leaps and bounds from where he was when the movie ended. For the most part, people are doing well.
Keith Fulton is co-director of the new documentary called The Bad Kids. It premieres tonight on PBS. And Vonda Wieland is the principal of Black Rock High School. Thank you both.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up on this program, Malibu is 92% white, but it is now a sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants. The move was inspired by resident Martin Sheen. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. California has a new sanctuary city, Malibu. Despite the city's liberal leanings, the vote was a tight one, 3-2, and it had all the trappings of a Malibu political debate. Heated oratory, class issues, Martin Sheen. Malibu City Councilwoman Laura Zahn Rosenthal sponsored the sanctuary city proposal, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Also joining us, LA Times reporter Benjamin Oreskes, who covered the council vote for the paper. Hi to you.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Laura, let's begin with you. Why did you want Malibu to become a sanctuary city?
Well, there were a few reasons. The first one being that after I did a little research, I saw that we had a number of families and a number of kids at our local schools, and I felt that it was very important to protect them. And I spoke with our local Boys and Girls Club, and they have places in all of our local schools, and they were very concerned, and they said the kids were scared and the parents were scared. So that was the first reason. And then the second reason was I wanted to send a message. I wanted to send a message about the policies of the Trump administration and how Malibu would feel about them.
So these kids and parents who are scared that you just mentioned, they're undocumented?
Some of them are.
And yeah. They're in the Malibu schools? Because I know you share with Santa Monica.
Yes, this was only Malibu schools. We're part of a school district with Santa Monica, right. But we have four Malibu schools here, three elementary schools, and then a combined middle and high school.
Okay. All right. And Benjamin, what is the role here of President Jed Bartlett, a.k.a. Martin Sheen?
Well, at a December hearing, city council hearing, he got up to thank the city council for standing in solidarity with Standing Rock, the Indian tribal reservation where people were trying to build a oil pipeline through. And while he was thanking them, he also mentioned that Malibu should become a sanctuary city as well.
And so he was the impetus, the original impetus?
Councilwoman Rosenthal told me that she heard him speak and thought it might be a good idea, and that sort of spurred her to do more research and introduce a resolution.
Councilwoman?
Yes, he's right. I had been thinking about it, actually, ever since things had been changing in Washington. And mm-hmm. I think when Mr. Sheen came and spoke to us, it just really pushed me to actually do something about it.
All right. So the jailing services, though, are contracted out, I suppose, to the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. You don't have your own police department, right, in Malibu?
Correct. We use the sheriffs.
Okay. So they have their own rules and regulations when it comes to the undocumented and when they're arrested. So what exactly does it mean to be a sanctuary city in Malibu?
Well, it really means that we are not going to ask our sheriffs, as you said, they're already not doing this, to work with the federal ICE officials and help round up people just because they're undocumented. This is nothing to do with suspending the rule of law or the federal government coming in when there are criminals. It's just really we're saying we want our sheriff's department to deal with our community safety and other issues within our city and not be and not have to do these extra things that the federal government might ask them to do.
Benjamin, you spoke with some people in Malibu about this. How are they feeling about it? It was a close vote, 3-2.
Yeah, well, it was a close vote. And certainly workers in Malibu, the people who do the gardening and work in the restaurants, some of whom are undocumented, were happy with this measure. It was symbolism, definitely, for them. But they, as Councilwoman Rosenthal said, are scared right now. The rhetoric coming from Washington doesn't help. And anything that sort of shows that the people of their community or the people where they work are standing with them helps.
Well, they don't live in the community, but they work in the community.
Yeah, a lot of the people I spoke with were taking the bus from Santa Monica after having taken the train or were driving hours to get there from places like Compton or South Central. And I actually didn't meet anyone who was working in these restaurants or in these, you know, houses who actually lived there.
And Laura, what do you say to people who might look at this a little bit askance and think, well, these residents, they just want to protect the people who work for them? In other words, they want to make sure that they still have gardeners and maids and restaurant workers.
I understand that. I mean, Malibu has a reputation for good or for bad. We really aren't that reputation. We really are just a small community, a small little town that happens to have a number of celebrities living here, but most of the people here are not. Most of the people work hard, they got lucky, or they moved here like myself almost 30 years ago. Before it really boomed the way it has now. So, again, I don't care if you're undocumented. I don't care what it is. We want to help, and we want to send a message. A few weeks ago, there was a rumor that went around, and I heard it in Malibu for a number of different people, and I know it went around in other parts of L.A. and maybe even the country that ICE was going to be doing raids on buses coming into different neighborhoods. And it had a profound effect on our community. A lot of people didn't come to work, whether they're working for people here or for businesses. People didn't go to school. And I saw the panic in our community, for not just people coming in, but people wanted to help, and they were scared.
But again, being a sanctuary city, how would that prevent that from happening, those raids from happening?
Well, we can't stop that, but we can stop our sheriffs working with them and assisting them in any of those things.
Which they don't do anyway. That's not their policy.
Correct. So, yes, so you could say we sent a message that it really doesn't have any teeth beyond what the sheriff's already does, and that's okay. I'm fine making that statement.
And Benjamin, you spoke to some people on the council who are not fine with that statement, who voted against. What do they have to say?
Yeah, it was interesting. The council debate did not center around what we were talking about, around the people who work in this community. Council people and also residents who voiced their opposition couched their arguments in things ranging from the environment. Some said illegal immigrants, as they called them, didn't care about the environment. Others said this was a quote, corrosion of the rule of law. So the sort of opposition ran the gamut, and that other people sort of said that the symbolism really just showed that this was hollow and it was not worth their time. And even some said the city, which could stand to lose around $50,000 in federal funding if President Trump were to follow through on that threat, people didn't want to see that money go away. So there was a variety of different opposition, but at the city council meeting, most of it didn't center around the people who live there.
And Laura, what about that $50,000?
Well, it's actually $46,000, okay. Which obviously the three of us that voted for this, that we're willing to sacrifice that amount of money if that comes to it. And I've already gotten emails from people that are willing, you know, that have people in Washington that will help us with that. And I do know that other sanctuary cities like Santa Ana are dealing with much, much more money than that. And I think also when it comes to all of these other issues that came up, the irony for me is, you know, the destruction of our environment or wilderness in America, which one of my fellow council members spoke of, and it's definitely happening, it's not being done by or for immigrants. It's being done mainly by white people, and white people that go to these different places and don't take very good care of it. Immigrants, there's not an increase in crime when you have immigrants in a community. Some more research just came out about that lately. And those were the kinds of things that people were talking about, that we would be a haven for criminals, and that is absolutely not true.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Laura Zahn Rosenthal, Malibu City Councilwoman, and Benjamin Oreskes, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Julie Myers is back now.
I know.
Hello, welcome back.
Did you miss me?
Of course.
Thanks.
I always miss you.
Thank you.
Go away.
Listeners, if you missed me.
She needs a lot of positive reinforcement.
That's the only feedback I want today. however, we did get a lot of feedback on that Malibu segment and the fact that they have declared themselves a sanctuary city. Agent 721 commented, "Good for Malibu. I'm not sure it'll do much, but it clearly states that the city will not help ICE in its quest to destroy homes and families." But Wasco Man points out that ICE can go into Malibu and arrest anyone they want at any time. So this declaration, I'm not sure that it actually really means anything. Dr. Azen says, if you really want to be a sanctuary, why don't you create affordable housing and allocate it to low-income immigrant families? For now, this is just an empty gesture. Evelyn Nunez-Jones says, well, it took the election of Donald J. Trump to be in office for Malibu to finally realize their gardeners, cooks, nannies, drivers, cleaning ladies, and construction workers were all undocumented Latinos. And Mark Scantlin says, Malibu is sanctuary city. Aren't these the same celebrities that keep fighting to have the public beaches in front of their homes fenced off?
Ouch. Hmm.
Yeah, you know, I feel like Malibu residents speak up. We got a lot of Malibu hate on Facebook and around the internets, and I feel like the good people of Malibu should weigh in as well and defend this decision or condemn it if they weren't on board. The vote was 3-2, after all.
All right.
So, beach people, let's hear from you.
Okay. Thank you, Julie Myers. It is a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks, Madeline.
You're welcome. So, vote yes for Julie Myers at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.